From GPB News, this is On Second Thoughts. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have you found a community where you fit in? It seems like there are groups out there for just about any interest. For example, maybe you're a female cyclist. Or maybe you're a person who prefers to forage rather than rack up produce bills at the grocery store. And those are two groups you'll hear about on today's show. That's coming up this hour. First, though, we tested your opinions yesterday with a conversation about the importance of the preliminary scholastic assessment test. The PSAT has been used as a tool to help educators determine the academic abilities of high schoolers for years, for decades. This year, though, it's caused a lot of confusion for students and parents and teachers. AJC reporter Rose French explained.
You know, students and counselors and parents having a difficult time getting access to their PSAT scores because those scores and results are, you know, used by students to prepare for the SAT. And it's all new this year, so I think that it's sort of amped up. You know, the fact that they can't get these results is sort of, you know, maybe amped up what's already for many students, you know, an intense, sometimes stressful, process.
And here are your first thoughts.
This is Walker Hagen from Fort Valley. The problem with big tests like the SAT and the ACT is that they are used in determining how much potential someone has. While they should be just as rigorous, if not more, this test should be restructured and used to help figure out where someone's potential lies.
This is Steve Carr. This whole college thing is a scam. I took 40 courses, got a degree. For what? Lets me go through the door on supervising people? Supposed to make me smarter? Education is a product of economic development.
We'd love to hear what you think, and you guys always have opinions. So you can do what Walter and Steve did. Call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk, or just post to Facebook. And remember, we might feature your comments on the show. Navigating Atlanta streets on a bike can be really scary, even for an experienced rider. For a beginner, it can be really terrifying. But a new group of cyclists have made it their mission to make biking a more comfortable experience for all female-identifying people. It's called Babelane. And here to tell us how the group got its start is its founder, Brianna Isbell. Good morning, Brianna.
Good morning. How are you?
It's good to have you with us. And also with us is Katie Addition, one of the group's riders. Thanks for being with us as well, Katie.
Good morning.
So, I mean, first question you must get all the time, Brianna, is why all women?
I really just wanted to form like a safe place for women of all experiences to feel comfortable coming out and riding.
Were you riding with men and didn't feel comfortable?
Oh no, most definitely. Most definitely not. I'm sorry. My boyfriend got me started on cycling, so I ride with him all the time. It's never been an us versus them type deal. I really just wanted anybody to feel comfortable, like, coming out and expressing any, like, concerns or, like, insecurities that they might possibly have. And I found that a lot of times, like, women just feel less pressure when they're, like, riding around other women. So I just really want it to be, like, a safe place for people to, you know, come out and ride.
So, Katie, what attracted you about riding with women as opposed to just any group of cyclists?
I think it's just a little more comfortable. Something I like about Breeze Ride a lot is it's no drop, so, like, no one gets left behind. It doesn't matter, like, what your skill level is. It's, like, open to everyone. So.
Well, what happens when someone is, like, they're going up a hill or something, they're like, I need to stop, I need to get off?
Usually, like, we'll stop with them, or we usually have, like, a sweeper, so someone who stays in the back and kind of makes sure that no one gets left behind. And so it's very, like, inclusive and just, I don't know, it's just you are in the group the whole time. You're never really by yourself. So,
how long have you been riding?
I've been riding since July, and the group started in August.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about how dangerous the streets are here, because it's no joke. I mean, the statistics tell us that it is not exactly safe for bikers on the streets of Atlanta or even the surrounding communities.
Yep.
So how do you handle that?
We're really big on, like, the reason we ride in, like, such a tight-knit group is because, like, we have more of a presence on the streets.
You mean just literally people are more likely to see a group of cyclists rather than one?
Most definitely. If we're on, like, a super busy road, we usually ride, like, side by side. So that way it kind of forces the cars that are around us to, like, swerve out a little bit further. Because, you know, by law, they have to be 3 feet. But a lot of times, if you're riding by yourself, cars kind of like to push that and, like, push you more into, like, the sidewalk. But also by riding in a group, I'm hoping that, like, the beginner cyclists kind of see how we as a group maneuver around traffic. So that way, if they do decide to go out and ride by themselves, which I'm always hoping for, you know, they have experience with all these different traffic situations.
Katie, have you ridden in other cities, say places that might have bike lanes?
Yeah, I actually moved here from Portland, Oregon.
Oh, so that's like the ultimate bike-friendly
right.
city.
Yeah, I mean, Portland's super bike-friendly. There's lots of infrastructure for it. Tons of bike lanes. You know, even our bridges have like their own little like bike lanes separate from where the cars drive. But at the same time, like I think Atlanta has more of the passion that comes with cycling just because we don't have that infrastructure. And so it's like you meet another cyclist and it's like not only can you bond over loving bikes, but you also have this kind of like collective vision for the city and that you like want to see this positive change. And so it just, I don't know, the community feels like very connected in that way.
Were you aware of how bad it was here for bicycles before you got here? Or was that just sort of a negative surprise?
Yeah, I mean, the reason I moved here is because of my boyfriend, and he's been cycling in the city for a long time. And yeah, I mean, he's been on, you know, in bike wrecks, and he kind of warned me about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, and make sure you wear a helmet at all times, right?
Totally.
So let's go back, in the couple of minutes that we have, let's go back to the difference that it makes that you're riding with all women. And I was reading about your group on Facebook, I kept thinking, this must be like why women want to go to the gym without men? Is that sort of the same thing, that sometimes in athletic pursuits, having the gender dynamic can make things competitive?
Yeah, I really just feel like it might be just like the way that we were like raised in our society, you know, like whether we like it or not. I feel like a lot of times, like, I don't know, like there's like just like that added pressure if like there's like the other gender there. You know, I don't know really how to say it. Just because like it's not really like, I love riding with men too. I don't know. I kind of just like having like a little community of women on the side too.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not so much as like, you know, men aren't welcome.
You must get this question all the time.
Yeah, for sure. I don't know. Like, our endpoints, like, are men inclusive. So that way, like, the whole cycling community is welcome to come and, like, hang out with us and support us. I don't know. I feel like women's cycling is just kind of new. So a lot of times, like, that's what's stopping women from, like, coming out and riding. It's just, like, they don't feel like there's, like, really, like, a place for them.
Mm-hmm. Katie, you ride with your boyfriend, though, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. And yet you joined an all-women's cycling club.
Yeah, I mean, I think since I was new to the city, I wanted to, like, meet, you know, other women who had similar interests as me. And I have met some really awesome people through Beyblade. But, yeah, I mean, I love riding with my boyfriend, but it's also nice to have kind of just this, like, I don't know, just a group where we're all, I don't know, alike and kind of excited about the same thing.
It's hard to articulate. You know, I am hearing
that. Yeah. Like, I don't know. It's like a feeling. It's kind of hard to put it into words, I guess. So
that is Katie Addition. She is one of the writers with Beyblade, and Brianna Isbell is the founder of Beyblade. And you can get more information and how you could join the next ride. Visit facebook.com/BeyblaneATL. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Last fall, the state of Georgia sent out a survey to thousands of teachers to find out exactly how they feel about their jobs. The results were sobering, to say the least. 47% of teachers say they'll leave the profession within 5 years of starting, and nearly two-thirds said they would probably not encourage their students to pursue teaching careers. The survey also found many teachers are frustrated with excessive standardized testing, unfair teacher evaluations, and a lack of understanding from political decision makers. So we asked a few teachers to tell us more about the challenges in their profession.
My name is Roxanne. I'm a science lab teacher in Cobb County for elementary school.
My name is Dr. Sid Chapman. I'm the president of the Georgia Association of Educators, and I'm also a high school teacher.
My name is Brian Westlake, and I teach in Gwinnett County. The reason I think so many teachers are frustrated is there's not really an acknowledgement that it's gotten much tougher to be a public school teacher. And all the data shows this, points this out, with increasing levels of poverty among our school children and the challenges that they're facing. And this is at the same time that we have been given fewer and fewer resources to deal with this. And increasingly, we're told, well, you're not supposed to talk about those things going on outside the school. You're just supposed to, you know, make miracles happen inside the school.
evaluation process is overwhelming, and 50% of the evaluation is based on standardized testing of their students, and a good number of the students are not good test takers or may not be there on a regular basis, but they teach different kinds of students and different socioeconomic backgrounds or transient students or what have you, but they're held responsible for how they perform on those tests, and they're of course reflected in their evaluation. It's up to like 6 observations for even veteran teachers.
When I came in, I wanted to make a difference. With all the experiences I had, I came in, how can I improve this school my own way? We need to get them involved. We need to get the parents involved. But it's very hard for these parents that work second job, the third job, turnkey, kids going home. You know, that's the same old, same old. I was in that predicament when I was little. My mother used to work in the mill. So I never saw her. So everything I did as far as learning, my older brothers helped me. And these are the issues that I see in my school that I would love to turn around. But here I am making only so much money and only able to do so much. It does require a village to grow these kids, not just a single teacher.
It makes it difficult when you're trying to teach in some of these abstract concepts, and their day-to-day life renders them very tired, exhausted at school. Their mind is on other things. You know, they might, you know, I've had students get evicted in the middle of the semester. There's all kinds of issues that we're dealing with in the school that have their origins outside the classroom.
I had been driving a 19-year-old car. I just turned it in to get me a newer car, one of the cheapest cars on the market. Just because I can't afford with my paycheck being a single mom because I've got one kid now in college. It is very hard, very hard.
I think the legislators, we're lobbying them hard. They're hearing from teachers back home, and I think they put the pressure on the governor to start listening. And the, you've got to have the people who are in the classroom at the table talking about what works and what does not work and what's needed. You can't just have people who have no clue as to what's going on in the classroom or in a school making those decisions without being advised well.
If you come in with no heart, yeah, you can only live 5 years, maybe less. If you come in with a heart to make some changes, then you stick out, ride the storm. And I'm out there on the front lines. I believe in speaking up for these kids. And that's what's important. These teachers coming in, they have to have the gumption. They have to have that extra courage to plow through all these issues that we have to deal with daily.
Our thanks to those teachers and educators all over the state of Georgia. So what do you think? What can we do to make teaching a more attractive career path? Share your ideas on Twitter at OSTTalk or call us at 404-500-9457 and leave a message. This is On Second Thought. We've lost some amazing musicians in recent days. First, David Bowie, Glenn Frey of the Eagles, many others as well, actually. This week, we mourn the loss of a lesser-known but still important voice. Many people knew Clarence Reed as an R&B singer who worked with the likes of Timmy Thomas and Casey and the Sunshine Band. Here is Reed performing. Clarence had another persona, though. At times, he transformed into his alter ego named Blowfly. He'd wear a flamboyant costume with a mask and belt out some racy lyrics like these. Feeling more sexy than a pregnant toad. Checking out the scene on my CB, cause I don't want no bears f***ing with me. That's a big 10-4, good buddy. Yeah. However you may remember him as Clarence Reed or as Blowfly, he left a mark on Georgia music, and he died this past Sunday at the age of 76. Joining me to talk about his storied career is his longtime collaborator and manager, Tom Boker. Tom, first of all, I'm very sorry for your loss.
Why, thank you very much, and it is an honor to address the citizens of Georgia. Clarence is a proud Georgia boy. He liked to talk about his childhood growing up in Cochran more than he liked talking about making hit records in Miami much of the time. And Augusta, Georgia, has this very special place in his heart. He wrote the song Headquarters, Augusta, GA, for Bobby Bird up there, and he worshipped Mr. James Brown. And on our final album, which comes out next month, we really do terrible things to The Big Payback by Mr. Brown.
So, and yet, in some of the things that I've read, he wasn't all that enamored with his life farming. When he was growing up, I understand he got sent out into the fields, actually. And it was his grandma that gave him the nickname of Blowfly.
That is correct. Essentially, he had to leave school at the age of 7 or 8 when his father, Doc, died in World War II. And he went out, and when as a means of revenge, he would take songs he heard on the Grand Ole Opry radio broadcast, particularly Ernest Tubb. And I'm Walking the Floor Over You became a very nasty song about masturbation. And he, to try and get a rise out of the bosses on the farm, he would sing this to them, and they cracked up because Mr. Reed is hilarious. So they gave him more money to do that for 5 minutes than he made in a week's time. His grandmother saw the money, was convinced he stole it, dragged him by the ear, and showed him. They're like, he's a nasty little, you know, whatever. And we gave him the money. And so she went off and said, "You're a disgrace to the black race. You are no better than a blowfly." And little Clarence ran off crying, and he found a little playmate. And she's like, "But Clarence, without blowflies, the world would be consumed by germs." So there you have it.
Well, let's actually take a listen to Blowfly with what this again. We got to make sure people understand the distinction. This is Clarence Reed as Blowfly performing.
Started to run, felt laying on my ass from the shotgun. Got on my rig, covered my face, drove my truck through that place. But running with glass in the hand, crime was ever fine everywhere. Grand dragons on the ground with his ass bloody. I looked at him and said, "10-4, good buddy." And as I rolled off into the sunset, reached in the back and got a bottle of wine, looked in the mirror and said, "Can't stand myself sometimes."
I mean, I think people are used to us bleeping rap songs that are modern, but we're talking about he recorded his first Blowfly album back in 1971, so he was a trailblazer, at least in using swear words.
He was a trailblazer in just about every way you can be one. Mr. Reed's recording career dates back to 1963. In the mid-60s to late 60s, he pioneered the Miami sound. He introduced Casey and the Sunshine Band to Junkanoo music at his own wedding. The name of Mr. Reed's father-in-law's Junkanoo band, the Sunshine Junkanoo Band. Mr. Reed's wrote Mr. Casey's first song, "Sound Your Funky Horn." As far as rapping goes, well, I used to catch a lot of grief because I insisted he was the first rapper. But as it turns out, I had a very fortuitous conversation yesterday with Mr. Arthur Speck Colden, who was a session player at TK Records in the early 70s, which is where Mr. Reed made his mark. He told me that without a doubt, he recorded Rap Dirty between 1971 and 1974.
Which would have made it the
way earlier than King Tim and the Sugar Hill Gang. I mean, it's not even
Not even close. Let's actually listen to rapper Ice-T, who made a comment on this very controversy in the documentary The Weird World of Blowfly.
"I don't think anybody will really try to claim being the first rapper unless they really were. Rap, as we know it, is put and locked onto a beat and syncopated, you know, not just the poetry, but it has to be on beat. Rap Dirty was on beat."
So then tell me, why, Tom, why did he not get some of this recognition during his lifetime if he was that much of a trailblazer?
Well, it's twofold. One, nobody who is serious likes admitting that their music was made by a man in a mask and a cape, and a profane one at that. So there's that aspect of it. There's lots of so-called serious hip-hop people who, you know, they're not around so much. You know, I started with Mr. Blowfly, you know, we started touring for real in 2005. And back then we had what was called backpack rappers. And these people took themselves very seriously. In the punk rock world, you know, you would have people, you would have indie kids. And, you know, and as someone who came up in the punk rock world in the 90s, you would see these very serious people who were very serious about their music. And then they would go on to, you know, get corporate jobs. But so there's that aspect. And then there's the tragic death of disco, which somehow screwed up the inventor of hip hop, because TK was TK Disco. Right. And even though Clarence was, this, you know, was on technically Blowfly was on Weird World, that was a TK label. And when that guy blew up the disco records in Comiskey Park in like whatever year that was, 1981 or so, and everyone chanted disco sucks, there went Clarence's means of putting out the Blowfly records on a high scale. So he wound up being on a much smaller booty bass label.
It's a really interesting life. Tom Bowker, he was a record label in Miami called Overtown Records and managed Clarence Reed, better known as Blowfly. Reed died Sunday at the age of 76. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley hinted at a very deeply divided Republican Party in her response to President Obama's final State of the Union speech last week.
Today, we live in a time of threats like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation.
A lot of people think she was actually talking about GOP frontrunner Donald Trump. And it's a rift that The Nation magazine talked about recently, in which they tracked the history of the divided GOP back to Richard Nixon's Southern Strategy. Back in October, I spoke with Emory University professor Alan Abramowitz and asked him to explain when the divide in the Republican Party actually started. We began our conversation in 1964 when then-President Lyndon Johnson reportedly said, "I think we just delivered the South to the Republican Party for a long time to come." That's after the passage of the Civil Rights Act. But something else happened in 1964. Here's Senator Barry Goldwater of Arizona. He was nominated as the GOP's presidential candidate that year, and here's a very famous part of his acceptance speech.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
That has been quoted over and over again. So can Alan, can we go back and kind of explain what the Southern Strategy was? What was this kind of oddball coalition that Nixon's team put together?
Well, it was an attempt to pull in the traditional Democratic voters in the South, white Democrats, who had traditionally supported the Democratic Party since the end of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and unite them with the traditional Republican voters. And in 1968, when Nixon won the White House, George Wallace ran as an independent candidate, and Wallace, of course, was the governor of Alabama, former governor of Alabama, segregationist, and pulled in a lot of those voters. But in 1972, Nixon was able to unite those voters with the traditional Republican voters and win a landslide victory over George McGovern. So that was the biggest success story of Nixon's Southern Strategy. Nixon carried not only the entire South, but he carried almost every state in the nation, I think, except for Massachusetts and the District of Columbia. So ever since then, we've seen this shift of conservative white Southerners into the Republican Party. It took a long time. It didn't happen overnight. So the quote there from Johnson actually was not really accurate, because
that he just delivered the South to the Republican
no.
Party.
In fact, in 1976, of course, Jimmy Carter won every Southern state except Virginia in his presidential bid. And Democrats continued to hold a large majority of seats in Congress from the South and state legislative seats and governorships for a long time after that. It certainly was the end of the solid South, though.
Let's, and, I want to go back to this idea of the Southern strategy bringing together what were kind of polar opposites. So it was bringing together your traditional country club Republican who is focused on tax structures and business plans with these poor, mostly poor rural church-going voters, most of whom supported segregation. This clip here is from Vincent Hutchings. He's a political science professor at the University of Michigan, and he's talking about why Goldwater's message disturbed so many African Americans.
African Americans heard the message that was intended to be heard, which is that Goldwater and the Goldwater wing of the Republican Party was opposed not just to the Civil Rights Bill of 1964, but to the civil rights movement in large part as well.
And here, Alan, is kind of where I feel like maybe the nation, the piece in The Nation was written by William Grider. Maybe he's correct to a certain extent that the divide was always coming. In other words, those traditional country club Republicans who are focused on tax structures and things like that were never entirely going to agree with the social issues that were so important to the mostly rural Southerners that they brought into the party.
Yeah, I mean, there have been divisions within the Republican Party going way back. So what we're seeing this year is a continuation of, you know, this split within the Republican Party between, on the one hand, you've got the evangelical voters who are focused primarily on social issues, and on the other side, you've got the economic conservatives and more business-oriented voters. But, you know, really, if you look at the big picture here, the Republican Party overall is much more ideologically unified than it's ever been because they've shed their moderate to liberal wing. So what you have in the Republican Party are a bunch of conservatives, and some are more focused on economic issues, some are more focused on social issues. But in general, they're all quite conservative, and there just are no moderate to liberal Republicans left. So that, to me, has been the big change in the Republican Party. It's been that the moderate to liberal Republicans have been driven out of the party, and what you're left with is a coalition of different kinds of conservatives who emphasize different issues, but who are able to pull together, at least so far, they've been able to pull together and unite in presidential elections, at least. And I really expect the same thing to happen this year, because they're very united in one thing. It was very interesting if you watched that debate last night, that the things that got the biggest applause were attacking the media and attacking Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. And that's
so they
what unites
agree on what they oppose.
Exactly. They agree in that they all intensely dislike Obama. They intensely dislike Hillary Clinton. And it's this kind of what I've called negative partisanship that we've seen develop. And it, by the way, it exists on the other side as well.
Yeah. I wonder then, Alan, what to make of this. This is a comment from Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal during a recent presidential debate, complaining about his own party.
It is time to get rid of the Republican Party, start over with a new one that's at least conservative. Give Harry Reid and Pelosi credit. At least they fight for what they believe in. I want senators and House members in D.C. to fight for what we believe in as well. It's time to have Republicans with a backbone in D.C.
So what are we to make of this? And not only this, but, you know, the fighting in Congress where they can't agree with one another.
Yeah, and we've heard very similar criticisms of the Republican establishment coming from, for example, Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz wants to create a new, more conservative Republican Party. And the argument here is that the mistake Republicans have made in recent elections is nominating these sort of wishy-washy moderate conservatives. And if only they had nominated a true conservative, as Bobby Jindal said, you know, they'd be much better off, which is complete nonsense. I mean, it's an absolutely ridiculous idea.
Well, why do you say it's nonsense?
It's nonsense because if you do that, you're going to lose badly in a general election.
I see.
You know, so, I mean, this was, in fact, the exact same argument that was made by Barry Goldwater and his supporters in 1964. They talked about, at that time, a hidden conservative vote, and that by nominating a true conservative like Goldwater instead of the sort of what they called Me Too Republicans like Eisenhower, that the Republican Party would attract all these new voters, that they would sort of come out of the woodwork. It's exactly what Ted Cruz and Bobby Jindal and people like that are saying right now, that there are all these evangelical voters and other conservative voters out there who are not turning out because they're just not energized, they're not motivated to turn out to vote for a kind of establishment Republican like Mitt Romney or John McCain. But everything we know about American politics, all the evidence is that that's complete nonsense, that there's no hidden conservative vote, that these very conservative voters are the most likely to turn out and vote, in fact, and that all you'll do help the Democrats to attract the small group of swing voters that are left, will go disproportionately to the Democrats, and you'll energize their base. The theory that you can energize your base without energizing the other side's base is, I think, very, very mistaken.
That's Emory University Professor Alan Abramowitz. I spoke with him last October. This is On Second Thought. The next time you stroll down one of Georgia's many tree-lined streets, look up and look for fruit. Foraging is a rising trend in the food world. There are individuals and groups here in Georgia who pick and pluck food from places like public parks. And there's an organized effort in some cases. Robbie Astrov is an arborist and volunteer for Concrete Jungle in Atlanta. He leads foraging trips across the city and donates the produce to homeless shelters and food banks. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Also with us is Drew Boleyn. He's the executive chef and partner at the restaurant Number 246 in Decatur. Good morning, Drew.
Good morning.
And also with us, Ethan Welty, co-founder of Falling Fruit. It's an interactive online map that's extremely cool. It pinpoints edible fruits and vegetables in public spaces. Hi, Ethan.
Good morning.
Although the place where I live right now, there's like, when I look on your map, Ethan, there's one pear tree within a 10-mile radius of my house. So clearly somebody needs to be filling in the map around my neighborhood.
That could be you. We could talk about how you can get you started.
And your map is all crowdsourced, right?
Right. So it's everyone can contribute. So another reason to get involved, right, and grow the map in your neighborhood.
Okay. So let's then talk about, Robbie, foraging as a pursuit, because I would imagine that, okay, let's in the interest of full disclosure, let me say I grew up in Southern California. Southern California kids take fruit all the time. It's hot. It's a summertime. There's an orange growing right there on a tree. And so you grab the orange and you eat it. But when I said that to the people here in Georgia, they looked at me like I was insane. So there's a culture shift that has to happen, right?
Absolutely. Depending on where you live, where you're from, what culture you come from, this is something that is very common, or you get crazy looks.
Yeah. And Drew, now, did you grow up in a culture where it was common to grab an orange or a lemon off a tree?
Blackberries when I was growing up. I kind of grew up on some land just outside of Atlanta here. And growing up, that was kind of commonplace, going out picking blackberries.
Yeah, you walk along the creek and there's blackberries
peaches
there.
Peaches in the front yard.
Yeah.
So.
And you actually use it in cooking.
We do.
How do you do that when you can't predict what you'll get?
Actually, Robbie and I were just talking about this waiting outside. It's pretty interesting being in the restaurant. A lot of these smaller farmers, a lot of smaller foragers just kind of walk in the back door and, a moment's notice with a batch of, for instance, Robbie walked in the restaurant about a year ago with a batch of prickly pears, and we figured out
prickly
what to do with it
on
the fly.
Really?
So, yeah.
So, but that means if you get a batch of prickly pears and you're trying to make dinner for that night, right?
Yep.
Then you have to immediately come up with a recipe. This is not something you're slaving over. You have to come up with something.
Yes.
That's rough.
Yep.
Well, Ethan, can we talk about the legalities here for just a moment? Because I imagine that some people are worried that if they see an orange hanging over the sidewalk, they don't want to take it because they're afraid someone's going to come out and arrest them.
Sure. So, it's amazing actually how much is already growing in as street trees and in parks. So a lot of public space is where already there's a lot of opportunities for foraging. And then when it comes to private property, if it's overhanging private property, but growing on private property but overhanging public space, then that's almost all cases that's totally legal. Just like you're allowed to trim a tree if it's growing from the neighbor's yard into yours. And then finally, if it's on private property, then you would do as you always would, and you ask permission. You get in a conversation with your neighbors, and you get them talking about this, what you think is valuable. It's the fruit on this tree that is on their land that maybe they're not using themselves. And I think that's a really important conversation that, like, even groups like Concrete Jungle, they're getting into all the time to try to, you know, forge relationships with homeowners who have fruit trees.
And then let's talk to you as a member of Concrete Jungle. How many people do you know that are involved in foraging here?
Well, we are empowering volunteers to help us pick. We're also, as Ethan mentioned, working with private landowners to form relationships, to gain permission. Most of the fruit that we're picking is on public land, but we also...
Like in a park?
In a park, or on a city right-of-way, for example. But we're also... There's so many trees that are just getting underutilized, where the fruit falls to the ground and it goes to waste. And homeowners are very glad to have Concrete Jungle come, clean up the mess, and then we're able to donate that to homeless shelters and food banks.
What kind of things are you picking? I mentioned oranges and apples because those are really easy, or lemons. But there's also lots of things growing, berries, but mushrooms, other kind of things. What kind of produce are you getting?
Well, first of all, in Georgia, we're very fortunate to have a varied landscape with different climate zones and whatnot. Here in Atlanta, in the urban environment, there's so many great things. There's figs, apples, pears, plums, peaches, wildflowers, berries, mushrooms. So a lot of variety.
Now, there's and let me ask you about this, Drew, because people are often nervous about picking mushrooms because it's really hard to tell, right? We all heard the stories of people poisoned by mushrooms.
Yes.
You ate the wrong mushroom. And it's really hard to tell. I mean, would you probably steer an amateur away from picking mushrooms?
Absolutely. I've been picking mushrooms for, I don't know, 10, 12 years. That's kind of what I'm into foraging. But if you're not 100% sure on what you're picking... then, you know, leave it alone. It's, you know, there's an inherent risk associated with foraging wild mushrooms. But, you know, there's a few varieties here in the state of Georgia that I'm comfortable with picking 100%. But definitely, you know, if it's your first time out, I would, you know, read up on it, get some literature, check that out. There's a lot of stuff you can check out online. But, you know, meet some people in the community that are foraging in your particular area and, try and get involved with them and help. They can help you identify different types.
And here's the thing, Drew, is that foraging to a certain extent also requires you to start to get to know your food a little better. And I say that because you have to start learning when fruit or whatever food is ripe.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people don't actually know that.
For me, foraging was really a great way to get in touch with the seasons, you know, and I think that's kind of what it comes down to. For me, I celebrate each new mushroom that's growing, and there's all kinds of different vegetables and produce that grow along with that. You know, right now I'm really excited about morels. We're going to start here at the end, probably towards the end of March.
Yeah.
A morel mushroom, yes. And that's kind of my celebration of spring. So I know, you know, with all of that, I know that peas are coming into season. I know that ramps are going to be coming up soon. I know that, you know, there'll be some fennelhead ferns kind of popping up in the woods too. You know, then we get into summertime and chanterelles, and we get into the winter or the fall, and we know that the maitakes and all these different types of mushrooms, and these are kind of the markers for these different seasons. And that's how I kind of identify, you know, sort of what grows together goes together sort of thing.
I want to make sure everyone's following us along. If you don't recognize every word that he used there, a ramp is like a wild leek. Right?
Yeah.
A chanterelle is a kind of mushroom. He just rambled off a whole bunch of stuff that you find. I mean, I'm new to Georgia, but there's ramps growing in my lawn, and a lot of people just mow them down. But, you know, why go to the store and buy some green onions when a lot of people have onion grass growing in their lawn? And, Ethan, I wonder, to what extent do you see a difference in activity from country to country? Are some countries more likely to encourage foraging than, say, the U.S. is?
There's a huge range. So I find that in the U.S., for example, there's been, you know, big news around forest gardens or public accessible orchards being planted, like in Seattle with the Beacon Food Forest, made really big media splash. But meanwhile, there's places like actually in Israel, I've had a lot of conversations there where that's actually been sort of standard for years now of this, you know, organizations, companies, people planting public orchards for all to come and harvest. There's olive trees in pretty much every city, you know, throughout, lining the streets. And every year people come out from all walks of life to come and harvest those. So there's a really wide range. I would say that in many cases, I find that there's a lot of urban fruit rescue organizations in the sort of Anglo-Saxon world, because that tends to be also places where people have lost touch a little bit in urban environments with the fact that there's food growing around the, you know, around the corner. And I think that's partly a response now that we're seeing this resurgent interest, because in a way we've lost it. There's a really clear distinction that's been made between urban environments and where our food is grown. And now we're realizing that actually, in many ways, those two overlap, and the food has a huge potential for food production. Even without trying, it turns out there's all these trees that are producing food that's going to waste now, before we even start maybe planting new sorts of food resources in our cities.
I want to dig in with all three of you into this idea of how we've lost touch, because I think that because of our worldwide distribution system, I think people have also lost touch of what is seasonal and what is not. I mean, you can get blueberries all year round, right? I mean, you can get stuff that's supposed to be seasonal all year round. People talk about the autumn and the gourds coming back, but butternut squash has never left my grocery store. Robbie, can you talk about how much of what you do is educational, just teaching people what grows and what is food?
Absolutely. You know, I think it was great to talk about how this act of foraging puts us more in touch with our food. Absolutely. But I think it's also putting us better in touch with ourselves and the world around us. You know, kind of a preface to even talk about why forage, but we need to recognize that as human beings, we've been largely disconnected from the natural world. And so when we're foraging, we're paying attention, we're becoming aware of the seasons and things are changing, and we're really gaining a tangible sense of place when we're outside our front door or in a neighborhood park. And so we're teaching that. And that's important because there's a certain time of year when something is going to be ready, or you learn how to identify a flower in early spring and come back to it in the summer when it's ready to fruit. So when we're teaching people, I like to use the term to identify towards a signature, something that will only be recognizable, that it's this fruit and this fruit only. And it could be a leaf, it could be the shape of the bark, it could be a texture, it could be a color, and it's happening at different times of the year. So by really paying attention and being aware, that's how you learn how to identify, but it's also how you enjoy life and just have fun outside.
Can we talk a little bit, Drew, about the benefit for a chef of using really fresh ingredients? Because it's something that we hear all the time and we sort of accept it as a platitude, fresh food. But most people don't use really fresh things, right? I mean, by the time it gets to a grocery store, it's been in a truck for a little while. What exactly makes a just picked berry better?
I don't know. I like to go in back to thinking about it seasonally. It's just kind of how we cook in the kitchens. It's a celebration of when something comes into season. You know, for an easy one to identify, you know, sweet corn, when you're getting it from your local farmer's market, it's just, there's something that's just better about it than buying the corn out of season. Or tomatoes. I mean, we all know that the tomatoes are going to be better in the peak of summertime, at least here in Georgia. For us, you know, when asparagus comes into season here in late March, or the sweet peas, it's there's something about taking it right from the vine into the kitchen that's just better.
Ethan, do you think of yourself as kind of an evangelist as well? Are you trying to get more people to forage?
Absolutely. I mean, we first built Falling Fruit, the tool, as something that existing foragers would enjoy using. But ultimately, the goal of this is to create, by creating this really comprehensive map of edible plants, you know, throughout the world and focusing in cities, we're trying to attract urban populations to the idea of foraging by making this exhaustive research for them to jump right in with. My dream is that people will see, wow, like there's already, you know, thousands of locations in my city where I can find food. That means that there's actually real potential for cities, and what if we expand on that? So I was looking, you know, my favorite example is the city of Toronto has 690,000 street trees for 2.5 million people, and only a fraction of those are fruit trees. But imagine if we started to engineer, all of those were planted by people. The entire urban canopy is engineered by humans. And so, well, if we just run with that, what if we were to decide that we wanted to get more food out of our cities? We could do that if we decided it was, you know, it was a goal of ours. And so there's, I think, by raising the demand, we could really start to rethink the way that we structure and build and plant our cities.
Well, then let me give you the last word here, Robbie, since we have just a couple minutes left. Can we talk about how that sort of chain of events of benefits? Because, A, there's the benefit of the person picking the food, right? And in your case, Concrete Jungle donates most of that food or all of that food?
100%.
So that's the benefit right away. But then you were also talking about other benefits in terms of helping the homeowner and then not having rotting fruit on the ground.
Yes, there's so many things working together. And it's a great connect the dot kind of project. We're forming relationships. People are learning more about their city. We're cleaning up this problem, quote unquote, of fallen fruit on the ground. You know, we say we're going to eat ourselves out of this problem. And then we're providing firsthand very nutrient-dense food to homeless populations, people that really need nutrition. And, you know, the other benefit is we're just having a good time. It's just so much fun to be out there picking fruit and doing something good for many people.
And for those people, at least they're doing good while they're not sitting on the couch. And, you know, with the obesity crisis in the U.S., never bad to get off the couch. we want to say thank you. And I assume all three of you would encourage getting more information before you start go out and picking fruit off people's trees, right?
100%. You know, we talk about, you know, these rules, you know, being 100% sure, having permission. And I would also add, lastly, to do this work with a sense of ethics, to never take everything, and just to be observant if there's a lot or a little bit. We want to make sure that we're harvesting in a sustainable manner.
That's Robbie Astrove, an arborist and volunteer for Concrete Jungle. Drew Boleen is the chef and partner at restaurant number 246 in Decatur, and Ethan Welty is the co-founder of Falling Fruit. Thanks to all three of you gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a good day.
You too. That's our show for today, but we want to hear from you. Would you actually feel comfortable taking fruit or nuts or mushrooms in your own neighborhood? Have you ever eaten a fresh fruit or vegetable right off a tree or vine? Tell us if you are a forager. Call us at 404-500-9457. We're also on Twitter at OSD Talk or post to Facebook. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.